来嘛来嘛，不让输了等你的，不让输了等你的，来嘛来嘛，哎来来来，不让输了等你的，放下来。
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies on iTunes and via the web. I'm your host, Nick Cheeseman, a fellow at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. Today I'm talking with Jan Nok Anji, a professor at California State University at Monterey Bay, about ties that bind cultural identity, class, and law in Vietnam's labor resistance, published in 2013 by the Southeast Asia Program at Cornell University. Anji, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why did you write History of Labor Organizing in Vietnam?
Well, first of all, I would like to thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my scholarship on this book that is truly a labor of love. This is essentially a 10-year effort, which puts workers' voice at the center stage of labor management state relations. And I sought to understand labor activism as the hallmark of Vietnamese history, from French colonial rule in early 20th century to 21st century of one-party socialist state system. So you asked me why I write history of labor organizing in Vietnam. When I was working on my dissertation, I was doing fieldwork in Vietnam for almost a year, and I was traveling throughout Vietnam. And at that point, I was looking at the role of the developmental state in Vietnam. And I interviewed factory owners of all types of ownership, ranging from state-owned to cooperatives to joint stocks. And I was so intrigued and moved by the toils that female workers endured in all the factories that I visited. So since then, after the dissertation, my focus has been geared more towards labor, all aspects of labor. Working conditions, labor rights, labor resistance, and my ongoing work on labor migration transnationally. I think it's important to write labor history because it sheds light on current struggles. That's what I've been finding. This book that I wrote now 3 years ago, I think still has a lot of relevance and currency in helping me understanding ongoing current developments, events. So it is important to shed light on current struggles. It also shows the power of historical legacies. As I mentioned, this book examines labor activism back to French colonial rule in early 20th century. And I found that kind of historical legacy continues to be true. To, you know, the 21st century. And those legacies continue to be very, very powerful. And thirdly, it also helps to show the motivational power, the fighting spirit of workers, in particular migrant workers who come from revolutionary places in Vietnam. Quite a few chapters in my book focus on migrant workers, especially chapter 5 on workers in FDI factories, foreign direct investment factories, and chapter 6 on private factories and underground factories. So history is very significant.
We'll work our way through some of the history shortly and also come into the current struggles. But before we do that, maybe we can pick up on some of the keywords. So you signal the importance of studying labor, but you approach it in a particular way. So one of the ways that you do that is through this term cultural identity.
Yeah.
In what ways does cultural identity affect how labor organizes in Vietnam, and what do you mean by cultural identity anyway?
Yeah, that's a great question. So cultural identity includes factors that essentially identify who you are and what binds you with others. It means in my book, I focus on the native place factor, where you're from, what is your birthplace. And that is significant because a lot of the workers that I interviewed read up their narratives are migrant workers. And if you know, in modern day factories, a lot of those workers coming from the countryside, rural areas or rural districts. So their native place, their birthplace is very important because they bring the cultural heritage. They bring the historical legacies with them to the workplace. So that's one factor of, cultural identity. The other factor is gender. And as I demonstrated throughout my book, a lot of strike leaders were women, and they look up to each other and they learn from each other. So gender is a very important cultural identity factor in my book. The third cultural identity factor is ethnicity, and in chapter two in particular, ethnicity is a very, very important factor because I demonstrate in there the solidarity of different ethnicities in class moments, which I explain in a little while. So ethnicity is also a very important cultural identity factor to explain what's behind labor mobilizing. And last but not least, at least in my book, religion is also a very important cultural identity factor. And in chapter two also, I found religion to be a very important factor that brought people together and how in class moment people transcended religion to fight. It is very important to understand these cultural identity factors because these social ties enable labor mobilization, leading to class moments in times of crisis. So workers utilize what cultural resources are available to them at particular historical context. So not all of the cultural identity factors appear in all of the strikes, all of the fights that I featured in my book. For example, native place, where you're from, basically, their birthplace, is central primarily for migrant workers who migrate from their hometowns, villages, to work in factory towns. But native place is not important for local workers because they're right there. They basically commute from home to work, and then they return home, you know, in the evening. Unlike migrant workers who stay in rental places, dormitories, if you will, and in exactly in those spaces that they bond with each other based on where they come from. Another example of some cultural identity factors are important, but not in others, is ethnicity and also religion. These two factors come into play very, very powerfully in chapter two, looking at the history of labor between 54 and 75. In that case, ethnicity and religion play a very important role in the two cases that I would love to share with your listeners. The Vimitex case, the 1964 case, the class movement there, and the case that I really, really appreciate, which is the Eagle Battery case. Both of them reflect very well how workers bonded together based on their ethnicity and religion and reflected that in their class moments.
I was just going to say, perhaps before going into those cases, could you say something a little more about what a class moment is and why class moments matter for your story and then go into those two cases?
Yeah. When you talk about labor resistance as a topic of this class, such as strikes, you have to consider collective action that happens during times of crisis and the many reasons for crises throughout the book. I'm talking about the death and injuries of fellow workers, physical abuses, repeated violations on labor rights, subhuman treatment, fleeing owners, the cicada factories, wartime brutality, underfunded social benefits, discipline, so on and so forth. when faced with those crises, workers, I argue, already bonded by their cultural ties or cultural identities, as I suggest and explained a little bit earlier, based on where they come from, their native place, based on their gender, based on their ethnicity, based on their religion, they already bonded on those cultural factors. When faced with those crises, they went through the whole long struggle. It's not easy to come to class consciousness. But when they faced with those crises, they struggled, they fought, and they became aware of belonging to a particular class, in this case, you know, working class, and they became aware of their common goals, common interests with workers of the other gender, of the other religion, of the other ethnicities, and some extent nationalities, at which point then they developed class consciousness during those, I would call, class moment. I'm sorry, it's a little bit long.
That's great. Can you move from that to offer a case study? So you mentioned the Eagle Battery case and the Vinatex case.
Uh-huh. So if you look at it in chronological order, the 1964 Saigon Vimitex case would go before the Eagle Factory case. So let me just quickly go over the 1964 Saigon Vimitex case. They're both in Chapter 2. So this is a very interesting case. I had a great fortune of interviewing two Hoa ethnic Chinese in Vietnam. They're one of the 54 ethnic minorities in Vietnam, and back in that period, they played a very important role in labor organizing. So I was able to interview two wonderful Hoa ethnic Chinese labor organizers, and they were both, they're still both Communist Party members. So this case is fascinating because Vimitex, the name itself is interesting. Vimitex, V-I-M-Y-T-E-X, that's the name. But it's like a combination of three different concepts. V-I means Vietnam. M-Y means American. And Tex means textile. So this was the largest textile mill in the South of Vietnam, established in 1960. When I mentioned the South, I mean below the 17th parallel, before the reunification of Vietnam in 1975. So all of these, you know, Chapter 2 took place before 1975, the mobilized thing. So this factory was established in 1960 with equipment and materials imported from the U.S., Japan, and Taiwan, basically U.S. allies. And it employed about 2,400 workers. Most of them were Hoa women, ethnic Chinese women. And this factory is important because it later on became Viet Thanh factory or Vietnamese victory factory under the communist government, which is another case that I took up in Chapter 4. So significance of this in terms of class moment and in terms of cultural identity, here we go. So in 1962, Vimitex workers basically invoking the stipulations of the South Vietnamese government, the Republic of Vietnam Labor Code, to demand for their rights, such as wage, collective bargaining, work hours, work conditions, and paid vacations. And when the demands did not get heard, they went on strike in August and November of 63. So in 1964, 800 of them were fired. In a couple of months later, the first firing took place in April. The second firing took place in August. Over 1,800 workers lost their jobs when management locked them out. So you have to understand the situation back then was a very, it's a raging war, raging Vietnam-U.S. war. And there was a strong presence of soldiers and police force throughout the country, throughout the South, basically. And the police used force to suppress this strike. So throughout August 1964, workers took turn rallying in front of the offices of the Labor Department and the Saigon newspapers. And all of these events leading up to a moment, a momentum for strikes in other industries that spread throughout Saigon, which led to a general strike on September 21st to 22nd, 1964. So I consider this a class moment, because at which point this predominantly Hoa factory workers allied with King workers in other sectors, in other factories to fight for their right. So in my book, I talked about archival materials showing that Hoa workers in nearby factory, in the Vinatexco textile factory, hoisted their Chinese banner side by side with Vietnamese banner to protest against oppression of Vimitex workers, in a sense, engaging in a sympathetic strike with Vimitex workers. Okay. There's one interesting fact that I got from my moving interview with Lu Gui. She was an underground Hoa labor organizer who was embedded in Vimitex factory. And she told me that back then, she was able to not only encouraging Hoa activists and King workers to join, but she was able to recruit a bus driver who was a Hoa, who supported the strike and then transported workers to the strike location instead of going to work in the factory. So it shows this kind of a cross ethnicity solidarity in this particular case. And then after that, she was exposed, and then another Hoa labor organizer, the second one that I interviewed, Mr. Ha Tang, stayed behind to continue with his labor organizing. So as a man, he was able to roam around as an electrician and continue to mobilize workers, King and Hoa, to support the strike. So that's an example of a very important case, a very important factory that spearheaded sort of, spearheaded the general strike in September of 1964.
So that case gives us a good sense of how workers mobilize in certain respects. One feature of their mobilization that you point to in the book is that as early as the 1930s, workers started to use and increasingly relied on the language of law in their petitions and demands. Why does this emphasis on legal language and protocol interest you?
I would love to say a little bit about the Eagle Battery case of 1971. In fact, that case will also get at your question about the use of law, because the use of law has been taking place back to French colonial time. It's not just a recent contemporary time. So I'm really struck by this 1971 Eagle Battery case, because it shows the significance of not just gender and ethnicity, but it also shed light on religion in labor organizing and protests. So, and I mentioned the law in this case also. So this factory is also extremely interesting. Again, also in chapter two, Eagle Battery Factory was established in 1951. Employed about 650 workers. Most were local Hoa female residents staying in Saigon, Jelun area. Most were Buddhists. Okay. But the historical significance here is that during the raging U.S.-Vietnam War, this factory was the sole supplier of flashlight batteries for the whole of South Vietnam and also for the South Vietnamese army. So class movements happened twice here. The first wave took place in March of 1971, and the second case took place in October of 1971, staged by both Hua and King workers. The religion, the significant, the interesting thing about this case is about the religious factor that played a very important role. Now, in this case, the organizers were Catholic. All of the workers, most of them, were Buddhists. So I found really, really fascinating role. I interviewed the two left-wing Catholic priests and the liberation theology wing of the Catholic Church in Vietnam at the time. And they call themselves Thanh Lao Công, which is a Vietnamese word for Catholic Youth Worker Activist, TLC. So I interviewed the former Catholic priest and a couple of TLC, Catholic Youth Worker Activists. And they were the ones who were behind the mobilizing, the organizing of the strike. And they played fantastic role in organizing them and protecting them using the law. Okay, so I'll let your readers to read the chapter to see the details of the book, to see the two waves of this strike. First wave, 23 days, March of 1971. Second wave, 34 days, from October to November of 1971. But the in both cases, the TLC activists appealed to the South Vietnamese rule of law to protect workers and to promote justice. They appealed to the law of the South Vietnamese at the time to protect strikers, and they even appealed to the parliament members at the time. Limited outcomes in this case, but nevertheless, the workers got the bonus for TET, which is TET is a well-known Vietnamese Lunar New Year. It happens most often, Lunar Year changes the date every time, every year. So it often happens in February. So workers always expect the kind of bonus for the Lunar New Year. So they can bring home, they can celebrate the Lunar New Year. So in this case, they got it. They got the bonus for then and overtime compensation. However, they didn't get, other demands, and the management fired all of the strike leaders. So in response to your question on the law, even back then, workers lodged a formal legal complaint with the Saigon Labor Department, again, with limited success, but they appeal to legal protocol, to the law, to fight for their rights.
In 1975, with the end of the war, Vietnam was reunified. And in Chapter 3, you take up the discussion with the reforms from 1986. Can you briefly explain what happened then and thereafter to set the scene for the chapters that follow?
Yeah, that's this is a tough question to really summarize such a long, long period of cycles of policies and reforms in Vietnam after 1975, punctuated by short-term retreats. So again, I would invite your readers, to listeners, to look at Chapter 3 with more explanation. But just to highlight some of the important periods. So I would like to put out these periods, because it's easier to understand. So between 1975, the end of the Vietnam-U.S. War, Vietnam was reunified, as you said. For the first 5 years, 75 to 80, the socialist government expanded its original command economy. Basically, the state controlled everything in the economy, from raw materials to production to the distribution of the final products. So the state essentially expanded this model, the Soviet style command economy, centralized economy, to the vanquished South. So totally under the same command economy. A lot of backfire, a lot of pushback, which then gave rise to the so-called hybrid transitional model between 80 and 85. And that was, this period was characterized by, on the one hand, concessions to the market economy type transactions that were beyond government officials' control. But yet, on the other hand, the government still tried to preserve the Soviet-style central planning model, so hence hybrid transitional model with back and forth, back and forth. But 1986, especially legalized in the six-party Congress, which lasted for 5 years, 1986 to 1995, the government, the Communist Party, basically legalized private interests in the free market system and legalized all the so-called fence-breaking activities, which is, read my chapter to know what they are, still with public interest. So since 1989, the state has called itself a, quote, market economy with socialist orientation. As you can tell, the inherent embedded contradictions in that name. This is a, you know, one party state, but with full fledged market economy with socialist orientation. So this kind of orientation underlies all of the contradictions that I argued in throughout all of my chapters. So since 1986, basically the government recognized the shortcoming of the command economy and legislated policy that moved Vietnam to the market economy. And in 1989, it is an important year when Vietnam called itself market economy with socialist orientation, due in no small part to the disintegration of the Soviet bloc and the collapse of the Eastern European countries. Or Eastern European markets, that was where the socialist government relied on in terms of exports and loans before the market system. So since then, since 1989, Vietnam has been opening up to capitalist system, the market system. Japan, countries in ASEAN, European Union. In 1994, the U.S. Clinton lifted the trade embargo, allowed Western capital to enter Vietnam. 1995, U.S. reestablished diplomatic ties with Vietnam. And in 2000, U.S. signed the bilateral trade agreement with Vietnam. So that all of those things culminated in 2002, Vietnam joined, 2007, I'm sorry, in 2007, when Vietnam joined the WTO. And since then, it basically opened the floodgate to, global capital investment.
And in that period, is the subject of the remaining chapters of the book, which you organize around different types of employment that labor resistance engages with, whether someone's employed in a state-owned or equitized mm-hmm. enterprise, whether mm-hmm. they're employed in a foreign direct investment factory or in a private domestic factory or an underground operation. Let's briefly deal with each one of these, starting with state-owned enterprises and equitized enterprises. So what's an equitized enterprise and what kinds of worker agency did you identify in those places?
Yeah, okay, good. So I I just briefly gave you some sort of a chronology of the political economy of Vietnam after 1975. And there's a one very important year that can shed light on Chapter 4, which is about resistance of state workers. And that was in 2002, the state, just to situate that in the chronology, the 2002 is right after the bilateral trade agreement with signed with the U.S. So in 2000. So in 2002, the Vietnamese state was forced, no doubt, by the U.S. and the neoliberal global system, IMF and World Bank, to privatize Vietnam's state-owned enterprises throughout the economy and also in the military. So the public sector went from employing 60% of workers in 2000, right before the equitization, to only 20% of workers in 2009. So let me just briefly explain what I mean by equitization. So equitization in Vietnamese is called cổ phần hóa. It's an ideologically correct way to express the transfer of public assets to the private sector in a socialist country. It essentially privatization of state-owned enterprises, but they cannot say that because they're still a socialist state. It's hyperbole. It's an ideologically correct way to say it. So state managers, supposed to, determine the value of these state-owned enterprises and sell shares to workers at discounted prices to make sure that workers can become co-owners of the factories that they used to work years and years and years before. In a sense, creating joint stock companies. And in Chapter 4, I featured many, many factories, many equitized factories, in those factories, state workers resisted the system that robbed them of their rights. One of the cases is the Mexico equitized biomedical company. Their class moment, the photo of their class moment, beautifully demonstrates on my book cover. If you recall the banners that the workers put on the book cover say a lot of things about how the state workers appealed to the socialist contract that they were supposed to sign with the state, and the state was supposed to comply or honor that, but they didn't do it. The state didn't do it. So back to the equitization process, the redundant state workers, so-called redundant state workers, were laid off in this process, and they were supposed to be able to get these stocks at discounted prices, but because they're so poor, they needed money to make ends meet, to put food on the table. So therefore, there exists this phenomenon called selling young rice, bán lúa non in Vietnamese, selling young rice, meaning that these workers sold their shares at low prices or short sales, if you will, back to state managers and private investors. So at the end of the day, these formerly state-owned enterprises, or now became equitized or joint stock companies, are now owned by state managers and private investors, no longer state workers. So that's the context for equitized equitization process. In Chapter 4, Bisico is one case that I mentioned, and there are many, many other cases I would invite the listeners to read. And especially the very interesting case, called The Hot Christmas. I'm just trying to turn my page to that case. The Hot Christmas Strike, in the Vietnam textile. And that took place in 1993. And this case is special. It took place before the equitization period in 2002. It is important because if you recall the Vimitex case in 1964, the one that spearheaded the general strike in 1964, that was the same factory. The same factory, same location, but different ownership. So if you fast forward from 1964 to 1993, now you have, you know, the Vietnam textile. After 1975, under the socialist regime, before the, even before a strike, as the strike was even sanctioned in Vietnam, these state workers staged a one-day sit-down, hot Christmas strike. This is a fantastic case. It shows not only the significance of cultural identity, but it shows historical knowledge, making use of what these older migrant workers understood about historical legacy, the Vietnam-U.S. war, to fight against the South Korean owner of this joint stock company.
Let's turn now to foreign direct investment factories. In those factories, strikes are relatively frequent. Why is that so?
Yeah. Okay. So that's a good question. Kind of a common question, actually. So my argument here is that, yes, you see that statistically, but why? So, I argue that ideologically, there's no contradiction at work. In a socialist state, when workers rise up against exploitative capitalists, right? They're not rising up against the government. They're not rising up to overthrow the government. They're rising up against exploitative capitalists, which is playing right into the socialist rhetoric. So the state then permitted, at times, permitted the media, the labor newspapers, to report on workers' protests against these foreign-owned companies. FDI stands for foreign direct investment. So it's very ideologically based. And I demonstrated that with the Freetran case, which is a very important case in Chapter 5, strikes in FDI factories. So the Freetran case is very important because it basically raised, as a result of tremendous class movement of dozens of thousands of workers in three main workers in this Linh Chung EPZ, export processing zones, which won the workers a 40% increase in minimum wage. Recall that the minimum wage was frozen 7 years before that, and it took place in 2005. So in this case, there are two class moments. The December 2005 minimum wage strike, which gave rise to the victory of 40% increase in minimum wage, and subsequently the 2008 strike, another big class moment, in which workers took to the street and fought and got the attention of the media and the government, who would then institutionalize inflation adjustment every year for the workers after that. So in this case, let's focus on the 2005 momentous case to win this annual minimum wage increase, broke basically the freeze 7 years before that. Cultural factor, cultural identity factors play a very important role. So I had a great fortune to interview the two migrant workers from the Central. Backtrack just a little bit. Linh Chung EPZ, Export Processing Zone, is in the middle of Ho Chi Minh City. And in that zone, a lot of poor migrants from the north of Vietnam and central of Vietnam migrate to work and stay near there. So I went to their rental places and talked to these two wonderful women from Guangnam, which is a central province, who rented rooms there. And it was a hub of a hub for migrant workers there. So I met them in 2008, but they showed me photos that they took on the strike slogans and graffiti drawn on the walls of the women's toilet from two strikes, the 2005 minimum wage strike and the 2008 inflation adjustment strike. So language like this would tell you the significance of class and also the significance of law. So, for example, one photo showed graffiti saying, like, wage like this, how can we live? Everyone, let's go on strike. So it evokes the idea of collectivity. Everyone, we, it's a sense of collective action. All of us have to go on strike. We have to go on strike. I also found in some of the graffitis, the language of law. For example, let's demand the rights and benefits for ourselves. And that really refers to or harks back to the 1996 labor code, which allows workers to strike. For your listeners, take a look at chapter 14. I mean, not my book, but in the labor code, chapter 14. I discussed that in chapter 3. Talks about how workers are sanctioned or allowed to strike. So another slogan, another graffiti saying that referring to the household registration law, which requires a kind of a living wage higher than a minimum wage. So in a sense, in the documents that I can gather on a firsthand basis, the class language is very clear, which harks back to the kind of a Marxist type protest. And also the law language, which also very prominent in these graffitis.
How do workers get information about these laws, and how can you say a little more about how they mobilize around law and why it matters, and something about what goes on in the making of a claim, whether it's successful or not?
Yeah. So, you know, in looking at over 100 years of labor history, labor activism in Vietnam, I can clearly see a trend dating back to the French colonial rule, when peasants, peasant workers, the brown-shirted workers, as I mentioned in chapter 2, already then they appealed to the legal systems and state institutions that governed them to demand justice and the right to strike and for better treatment and respect. So, for example, during the French colonial era, workers knew how to use evidence to back up their claims. They appealed to contract laws. And the first progressive labor code introduced in 1937 and 1938. So way back then, they already used the law. And in the 60s and early 70s, in the south of Vietnam or in the Republic of Vietnam before the fall of Saigon, workers invoked laws regarding free trade unions. Back then, between 54 and 75, there was freedom of association. There was freedom of labor unions. There are many, such a vibrant scene in unionism in the south of Vietnam, unlike now. There's only one. But so back then, there were laws regarding free trade unions, the right to strike, and even the protections for strikers. The Eagle Battery case I mentioned to you earlier talked about how these progressive Catholic activists and priests made use of these laws to protect the strikers. Up to the present day, under this one-party state socialist regime, workers too also refer to the laws to protect their rights, and they use the media to help them. Okay, and the role of the media is incredibly, incredibly important in all of the strikes that I mentioned throughout the chapters. So workers use evidence. Workers spread the word in the dorm rooms and rental places. Workers appeal to the media to help them out. Workers also got to know the law from dedicated local labor union reps. I mentioned this one case of this union rep. His name is Vu in Hoc Mon District in the south of Vietnam, who was really wonderful in empowering the workers by telling them how to file the claims and basically helping them. This is basically the case of Hai Minh, one of the cicada factories in the south of Vietnam. So just to summarize, in response to your question about how do they get to know the law and how do they learn from, you know, from each other. Basically, they learn through word of mouth in their rental places. They learn from the labor union representatives. They get help from the media. And one last thing, they also learn from legal aid center, like the Đồng Nai Center in the south of Vietnam, with the help from Oxfam, a Belgium Solidarity. So there's we begin to see a very important role of the global civil society in labor organizing in Vietnam.
A couple of times you've referred to cicada factories. I have to ask what they are, otherwise listeners will be confused. I presume they're not making small insects.
Right. Okay. So cicada factories. Okay. That is the topic for chapter 6, the fights of workers in private factories and underground factories. So cicada factories are essentially footloose factories. And these cases continue to plague Vietnam, continue to plague Vietnamese labor unions and workers for decades. So why cicada? They earned their name based on the perception that modern global capitalists morph and flee like a cicada, like an insect, that is shedding its skin and flying away. In this adaptation to the Vietnamese case, these factory owners, acting as predators, they abandoned the factories. They emptied out their factory machinery. By the way, most of the factory machinery are rental equipment. So when they fled the factories, not paying workers back wages, not paying workers social benefits, insurance, they basically turned the factories into empty shells to escape responsibilities to workers. So that's why I call them cicada factories, footloose. And there's so many cases that I cited in my book, the Hai Minh struggle between 2005 and 2007 is a wonderful representative case that I will invite your listeners to read. And it also in that case I also connect to a very interesting U.S. case in Chicago. It's called Windows and Doors. A similar phenomenon. Capitalists fleeing, emptying out, hollowing out the factories, and leaving workers stranded behind.
Have the trends from the 1990s and 2000s that you set out in the book continued up to the present day? I know you're still following events in Vietnam, so maybe you can speak to some of the more recent events and relate them to the contents of your book.
Yeah, so there's just so many issues in my book that I raise, but I would like to focus on two major triggers that I find connected to current labor unrest in the 21st century. The one trigger is still the minimum wage issue. Okay, so I mentioned the free trend glass moments in 2005 and 2008. So 2005 gave workers huge victory when 40,000 workers took to the street to fight in Lingqiong EPZ, which then spread to, you know, other factories there in Ho Chi Minh City. That was a huge victory with fantastic support from the local labor media. But now, last year, 2015, there was a huge debate on what to raise, what is the percentage of increase for the minimum wage to be applied in this year, 2016. And backtrack a little bit to 2013, the National Wage Council was formed, supposedly to replace indirect and separate consultation between the government and chambers of commerce and parties in the private sector, supposedly to streamline all of those private interests and influence. It sounds fair on paper, but in reality, it seems to me that the National Wage Council gives the state and management more power at the negotiating table. And why I am saying so, and this is I discuss a lot more in my upcoming chapter in the edited volume on Handbook of Contemporary Vietnam that coming out this year. And just to summarize my argument here is that the end result of this debate in 2015 gave rise to the smallest increase of minimum wage effective this year is only 12.4% as opposed to 40% in 2005 when workers took to the street. And it between 2005 and 10 years later, 2015, it's an erosion of the minimum wage increase down to 12.4, which is the lowest. So my argument is that there is an erosion of VGCL, the Vietnamese General Confession of Labor, at the negotiating table because of the increasing influence of management represented by the Vietnamese Chamber of Commerce and Industry at that table. So that's one trend. And that trend is not good because this kind of minimum wage policy is not helping the workers. It perpetuates the cycle of poverty. I would invite your listeners to read the four-tier system. I don't have time to develop that here. But that four-tiered minimum wage policy perpetuate the working poor in Vietnam for generations. The poor will continue to be poor and poorer, and their children can never advance. The second trigger is the connection between the minimum wage policy and the social security benefits for workers. Last year, I wrote a short article in the New Mandela. It's an online piece. It's entitled Small Victory, Systemic Problems. It is about a strike of over 90,000 workers that took place in March of last year. So please take a look at that to see. Basically, that strike was against the social insurance policy that was supposed to be implemented beginning of this year to not allow the workers to take out one lump sum Social Security before their retirement age. Okay. Young migrant workers, after 10 years working on the assembly line, can no longer work because they were squeezed to the last drop. So they would like to get out one lump sum, just like a form of saving, to bring home and use that as seed money to invest in some kind of a business venture to make ends meet at home. But when they were told that they were not able to do that last March, 90,000 of them went out on strike. And thanks to that huge class moment, the government basically retracted it and postponed the implementation of that clause. So workers now can still take out one lump sum if they so choose, or wait until their retirement age, 55 for women and 60 for men, and get their monthly pension. So in my latest piece, my argument is that there is an intimate connection between annual raise in minimum wage and Social Security benefits for workers, because management main concern is not so much the minimum wage, because most of them already paid higher than minimum wage. Minimum wage, by the way, is not livable wage at all. But management main concern is about having to pay higher social insurance premiums based on higher gross salary. Okay. And that they have to start doing in 2018. And they don't want to do that. That's why they keep on dragging their feet. And that's why they keep on dragging, raising the minimum wage to the lowest possible line. And they had this practice of keeping two accounting books for years. One for taxation, basically, based on the total wage, which would include the minimum wage and all types of allowances to make ends meet for workers. And the other one, the other book, is for the lower amounts to contribute social insurance to the state fund. So those are the two triggers that I see continue to be the trends, informed by the arguments made by my book. One is the ongoing significance of the minimum wage struggle, which is not livable, and the second thing is a connection between the minimum wage and the social benefits to workers that would affect not just this generation of workers, but their children and their children's children. And essentially, the Vietnamese society, the Vietnamese government, will have to subsidize the global capitalists to pay for these workers in their old age, for their health care, for their unemployment insurances, so on and so forth.
Thanks for that summation. And you've also pointed to a number of other pieces you've written that people can take a look at if they're interested to learn more. Is there another book on the horizon? Do you have another large work in progress that we can also look forward to?
Yes. I'm glad you asked that, because, I am working, my ongoing manuscript right now is again, I'm looking at the issue of labor resistance, but now across borders. I'm looking at migrants from Vietnam going to work in Malaysia and return, and how they fight, how resistance takes place across borders. So essentially, I'm focusing not just on the King and the Hua ethnic groups, but I'm looking at three other ethnicities. So I'm also looking at the Cham Muslims, the Khmer, and the Hoare, and I'm exploring how they temporarily migrate from Vietnam to Malaysia for work and return, and how they and their families resist against indebtedness, you know, because they have to take loans to go to work in Malaysia, which is low-paying, low-skilled labor destination, if you will, and the kind of vulnerabilities that are created by labor export policies of the Vietnamese government. So I'm looking at transnational migration. I'm looking at third space. I'm looking at how these five ethnicities fight for their survival. So this work also relied on more than 8 years of fieldwork materials on the ground, interviewing with these five different ethnicities, both in Vietnam and in Malaysia.
Well, you certainly have to keep us informed as to when that comes out, because it sounds like another a very rich and important contribution that you'll be making with that work.
Jan, absolutely.
Angie, I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with me today about ties that bind cultural identity, class, and law in Vietnam's labor resistance.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to everyone for listening. I look forward to having you join me again for another meeting with an author on new books in Southeast Asian studies. And if you have time, do check out some of the other great podcasts on offer via the New Look New Books Network. Hey,